quietly entered, sucking on a lollipop. He got down on one knee and asked Shai to marry him. In tears, she said yes. A month later, on November 6th, Aaron's birthday, Aviel Janelle Hernandez was born. Aaron was excused from practice to be at Shai's side in the hospital. He called me to share the news. "She is so precious, Dee," he said. "I can't believe I'm a dad now." On December 22nd, I returned to Boston from Florida to meet Aaron's daughter for the first time and get a tour of his new home in North Attleboro, Massachusetts. When I walked through the door, Aaron was holding baby Aviel. She was perfect, the most gorgeous human I'd ever laid my eyes on. Aaron made me scrub my hands with sanitizer twice before I held her, and she immediately melted my heart. She had done the same thing to Aaron, who couldn't stop looking at her. It was a struggle just to get him to let me hold her, because he didn't want to let her out of his arms. He was fully consumed by his baby. He showed me around his beautiful home, which featured 5 bedrooms, 6 bathrooms, a hot tub, a sauna, a theater room, a backyard pool, and a massive playhouse. I couldn't stop thinking about how his garage was bigger than our childhood home. The next day, the Patriots hosted Jacksonville. Aaron had 1 catch for 13 yards in New England's 23-16 win. The following evening, we had our annual Christmas gathering at a cousin's house in Bristol. Aaron showed up without the baby. "I didn't want to bring Aviel because I don't want her to get sick, so she's home with Shai," he said. For several minutes, as Aaron and I talked, he appeared happy and so content. The brother I knew was by my side. Then, as suddenly as a lit candle blows out, Aaron changed. He quit talking. He quit smiling. He seemed preoccupied, focusing on something only he knew about. I asked a family member to take a picture of Aaron, me, and 2 of our cousins. When I looked at the photo, I noticed that everyone was smiling except Aaron. "Aw, Aaron, you didn't smile," I said. "Let's take another one." We retook the picture. The result was the same. Aaron still had a dark expression on his face. "Aaron, what's wrong?" I asked. "Why aren't you smiling?" "I was," he said. We took another photo. Same result. I finally gave up. Chapter 23. January 2013. After the holidays, I returned to Florida. I carried my luggage into the apartment I had finally rented in Miami and dove onto my brown sofa to relax after my flight. The scent of trash filled the apartment from the dumpster outside my broken sliding glass door. I was still struggling with being alone after my divorce. The next day, my fortunes changed. I was offered a job at the University of Iowa as a graduate assistant. At Iowa, I would be responsible for coaching the tight ends. I missed being a position coach. I told the Miami head coach how much I appreciated working on his staff before I accepted the position, and I booked a flight to Iowa. I spent the first 2 nights in Iowa City sleeping on a couch in the football facility. On the second night, I was awakened by a custodian vacuuming the players' lounge.
He must have told offensive line coach Brian Ferentz, the son of head coach Kirk Ferentz, that he found me there, because the next morning, Brian poked his head into my office and invited me to stay in a spare bedroom in his house until I found my own apartment.
That night, Brian, who had coached my brother in New England, invited me out for a pizza dinner. Once we ordered, he started talking football. He cleared space on the table and, using salt and pepper shakers and sugar packets, began moving them around as if they were players on a football field. He pulled a pen out of his pocket and began teaching me zone-blocking schemes. Immediately I was sold.
My father had briefly played with Coach Kirk Ferentz at UConn.
Whenever we had watched Iowa play in our living room, he raved about him, saying what a great man he was, a man of character and kindness. When I received a recruiting letter from Iowa in high school, my father proudly posted it on the refrigerator. They never offered me a scholarship. I knew I wasn't a national prospect, but my father continued to tell me how special the coach who led the Hawkeye program was. On my third day, I went to Brian's office and we started studying Patriots practice film of my brother and Rob Gronkowski. I took notes, writing down every word he was saying. He told me to put my pen down and just watch the tape with him. He said I could look at his own notebooks, the first time a coach had ever been willing to share his own football secrets with me. I found an apartment, and my outlook on life turned sunny. The people I was around each day cared for me and looked out for me. The Iowa program was one big family. I called Aaron often and told him about the coaches and how family-oriented everyone was.
"Dee, I love how happy you sound," Aaron said. "Your time is coming. You are with the best, and I know one day you are going to be a big-time D1 coach. I can feel it, Dee. Just keep working hard."
In February, the Iowa coaches had a break. Aaron invited me to spend time with him in California, where he was staying in the off-season to work out. Shai and the baby were with him. I stepped out to the curb at Los Angeles International Airport and spotted Aaron's white Audi. He rolled down the passenger's side tinted window, Shai was driving, and popped his face out. Two big dimples and a radiant smile. As I neared the SUV, I could feel his happiness. I got in the back seat and sat to the left of Aviel, who was buckled into her car seat. I couldn't stop looking at her, and neither could Aaron. He constantly turned around to gaze at his 3-month-old daughter.
"Isn't she precious, Dee?" he said. "Isn't she the most beautiful princess you have ever seen? I am the luckiest man in the world."
We drove to a mall where there was a Macy's.
Aaron told me to pick out a few shirts for work. I asked an employee where the sales rack was located, but Aaron stopped me.
"It doesn't have to be off the sales rack like when we were kids," he said. "You're such a dork."
With my new shirts in a bag, we drove to their 2-story rental home in Hermosa Beach. Shai showed me to my room, and I took a shower. Once I was finished, I put on my jeans, one of the new shirts, and went into the living room. "Where's Aaron?" I asked Shai. She told me to check the roof. I walked up the swirling staircase and opened the door. It was evening now, and in the dark distance, I saw Aaron sitting at a table. There were small lights along the edge of the rooftop that created a relaxing orange glow. I moved toward Aaron. Sitting alone, his eyes were focused on his lap. I took a seat next to him at the table. He was holding a gun. I looked at him, and his eyes met mine. He had a defeated look on his face. He turned his head straight forward, looking out past the roof lights, past the beach, and far away into the dark night over the Pacific Ocean. That was when I noticed one bullet lying on the table directly in front of him. I was concerned for my brother. "What's wrong?" I asked. He didn't answer. He kept staring straight ahead, like I wasn't there. I studied his face. It wasn't dark like it was during the Christmas photo. He appeared lost and sad. "Aaron," I said quietly. His eyes didn't move. He was in a different state, a different world. My voice couldn't snap him out of it. He raised the gun from his lap and placed the tip under his chin, then slowly grazed the tip of the barrel back and forth from the edge of his chin to his Adam's apple. I was worried by how disconnected he appeared. He looked empty. I thought about touching him, but I was afraid because of the position the gun was in. But I had to do something. I tenderly tapped him on the shoulder. "If you don't put the gun down, I'm going to go downstairs," I said. I waited a few seconds and then stood up to leave. He reached for me with his left hand.
"Dee, stay," he said, placing the gun down on the table.
He looked at me and smiled softly, a smile that didn't reveal his dimples. It reminded me of the smile a stranger gives to another stranger when you accidentally make eye contact in passing. Only 2 hours earlier, he had seemed like he was on top of the world. The sudden change in Aaron was staggering.
"Are you okay?" I asked.
"Dee, I'm fine," he said softly.
"Are you sure?"
"Dee, I'm fine," he said.
"Why do you have a gun?"
"People have guns, Dee," he said.
He said Shai should be dressed and ready to go out now.
The babysitter had arrived when I had gotten out of the shower, and we needed to move downstairs. Aaron rose from his seat, and I followed. I looked back at the gun and the bullet on the table, wondering if the gun was loaded. From behind, I squeezed the back of Aaron's neck until he flinched. This was something our father did to us as kids. Aaron turned at me and smiled as we descended the stairs. Early the next morning, my brother's hands shook me awake.
"Dee, I have to go to Florida," he said. "I'm leaving in a few minutes."
He had invited me to spend the entire week with him, and now he was leaving less than 24 hours after I had landed. How could he forget that he was scheduled to fly across the country? Was this just the life of a high-profile NFL player? I stayed in bed after he left the room until I heard footsteps scrambling around the house. I stepped out to watch him, and it seemed like he didn't have the focus to keep up with what he was trying to achieve, gather enough belongings for a quick trip to Florida. He reminded me of a scattered child who didn't have his list of reminders directly in front of him. I went back into my bedroom. Before Aaron left, he walked in to say goodbye and handed me a phone number.
"Dee, if you need anything or want to do anything, give this number a call," he said. "This guy's a good guy and he's from the area. He will take care of you."
Aaron gave me a hug and a kiss on the cheek and then said, "I love you." At the door, he apologized repeatedly.
"I don't want to leave, but I have an appearance in Florida that I forgot about," he said. "I can't miss it."
I didn't remain upset for long. I attributed this to Aaron being Aaron. If he didn't have a to-do list written out, he struggled with concentrating on the tasks he needed to achieve that day. I understood this about him, and was one of the things I loved about him. This was why I arranged a youth football camp around the weekend of my bachelor party, because it increased the odds of Aaron remembering to show up. Aaron returned from Florida on my last night in Los Angeles. We went to a comedy club, and afterward, we spent the rest of the evening talking and laughing and sharing stories. On the way to the airport, Aaron asked if I had enjoyed the previous night.
"Aaron, it was perfect," I said. "It felt like we were kids again. Just the two of us."
Chapter 24. April, 2013. I could feel my mother's disappointment building through the phone. 2 months after I visited my brother in California, Aaron had invited her down to Miami. She had just returned from her trip. At the airport, I was greeted by a limo driver who was going to take me to the Fontainebleau Hotel, my mom said. I sat in the limo excited to see my son, but I was also a little nervous, because I never knew which Aaron I would get, the good Aaron, the angry Aaron, or the disinterested Aaron. The hotel was beautiful. I walked inside and went to the front desk. Aaron forgot to show up, and I wasn't going to hand over my credit card because I couldn't put a balance that big on my card, and Aaron was aware of that. The room he booked was around $1,000 a night for 4 nights. I was waiting in the lobby because they weren't going to let me into the room without a credit card on file. I had to beg the people who worked there to let me go in because my son wasn't there for me. Do you know how embarrassed I was? I didn't care about this uppity hotel or the damn limo ride. I could care less about that shit. I came here to see Aaron, and I didn't even see my son until the last night I was there. I was relaxing on the hotel bed, watching TV, when Aaron walks in the door with a designer book bag over his shoulder. Behind him are 4 goons with gold teeth and a stripper. He came over to me and gave me a kiss before sitting on the end of the bed near my feet. The other people were out in the balcony smoking, and the prostitute lady was just sitting across the room in a chair. Aaron dropped his book bag off his shoulder, unzipped it, and poured all of his money out onto the bed we were on. He started counting it, It was a ton of money. I asked him, "What is all this money for?" He said, "I'm renting high-end cars for everyone. We're talking like a Maserati, a Lamborghini, a Benz, and so on." They were in my room for about 30 minutes, and then they all left. Erin returned to her hotel room the next morning, wearing the same clothes and stinking of booze. He laid on the bed right next to me. He was so hungover. She just kept saying, "Erin, you were not raised like this." He had already made arrangements for a limo driver to take her back to the airport, but now he offered to take her himself so they could spend more time together. "No way in the world," she said. "At that point, I just wanted to go home. I was pissed." Looking back on it later, she told me, "Over the years, all I ever wanted to do was be with Erin and to see how he was doing. But at that time, all I could see was how much he was changing. I thought it was all my fault. I would ask myself, how could my baby turn out like this? As much as I loved him and loved to see him, I started to hate being around him. As a parent, it is terrible seeing your child head down a path and not be able to do anything about it. I tried and I thought I would be able to help him, but he had stopped listening to me a long time ago." "I met your brother at a club called Greystone, and from there we started hanging out," Ralph, one of Aaron's L.A. friends, told me. "I didn't notice anything out of the ordinary, beside the fact that he came on to me one night. It was shocking to me, but it didn't affect my friendship with him. Another time, we were in the bar at the Roosevelt Hotel, and Erin was coming on to a male bartender. I noticed it, and Erin saw that I noticed it. Erin looked over at me and said, 'Please don't tell anybody.' We talked after, and he said how it was so difficult for him being an NFL player, having a fiancé, and having a baby. One night, we had strippers in a hotel room, and I could tell Erin wasn't entertained like I was. He just kind of sat there, in his own world, with a blank look on his face. I was like, 'What's up, dude?' And he said, 'Man, I'm not really into it.' I told him that we didn't need the strippers and we could have them leave. He told me that he was going along with it because he thought that was what I wanted. We walked out onto the patio to have a conversation. He said, 'I love Shai and my daughter and my family, but when it comes to my sexuality, I am really confused.' We then talked about him being open in the NFL. I thought that was the direction he was going in." Another L.A. friend, Keith, described another evening at the Roosevelt. "Erin was really fucked up when I got there," he said. "Erin was flirting with the male bartender. That night, Erin was over the top with his flirting in public. I finally told him, 'Erin, you can't do this shit here. This is Hollywood. You will be on TMZ in 2 days. He looked at me without saying anything. It was for an entire minute he looked at me, a long eye exchange. I'd called him out, and he finally said, 'I ain't no faggot.' I asked him not to say that in front of me because I have gay friends, friends who are comfortable with their sexuality. I could tell that Erin had a lot of self-conflict. Erin was struggling to accept himself as a gay man." Chapter 25. June 2013. 3 weeks later, I was on a plane heading to One Patriot Place to complete a 4-day internship. I'd asked Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz if he could help me land an internship with an NFL team so I could continue to develop as a young coach. He made a few calls, and days later, I received an email from the Patriots inviting me to attend their off-season workouts. I was excited for two reasons: to learn, and to see my brother. A day after landing in Boston, I went to Aaron's house, where he was having a birthday party for Shai. I arrived in the afternoon. Erin played the role of the gracious host. He talked to guests as he moved from the outdoor pool area, where I was seated, with a dozen kids and adults, to the man cave downstairs. Erin had a massive outside built-in grill, and I helped Erin cook burgers and dogs for the group of 20, which included Shai's sister and her boyfriend, Odin Lloyd. As I was cooking, Erin jumped into the pool with his daughter, Aviel. I looked over the open grill lid and saw him guiding her around on a floaty in her pink sunglasses. It was beautiful watching them together. We sang happy birthday to Shai, and the group enjoyed a cake that Aaron and Shai had ordered for the special occasion. I walked downstairs, wanting to see if the pool table was available. Odin was there, sitting on a tall bar stool. We played a game. He was very friendly and soft-spoken. As I was chalking my pool stick, I heard my brother say from upstairs that a limousine would be picking everyone up later that night. When the time came, about 10 of us loaded into the limo for the ride to a club in downtown Boston, about 45 minutes away from Aaron's. After taking our reserved seats on the stage and getting our drinks, we toasted Shai. For a few hours, we enjoyed the music and danced. Around 2 a.m., the limo took us back to Aaron's house. I went downstairs to the guest bedroom. Minutes later, I heard loud voices and bangs from the upper floor. Thinking someone might have fallen, I jogged up the stairs. When I got to the living room, I looked up to the second-floor balcony and noticed there was a king-size mattress outside my brother's master bedroom, pressed up against the railing. Then I saw Shai's mother come out of the second-floor guest bedroom in her pajamas. I walked up to the second floor. Shai's mom asked her daughter, who was standing in the doorway to her and Aaron's room, what was going on.
"Aaron can't find his cell phone," Shai said.
I wanted to talk to Aaron, but I sensed that something was going on between him and his fiancée. It wasn't the place to pry, so I called it a night. Early the next morning, I started packing my bags, excited to begin my internship. As I was making the bed, Aaron appeared at my bedroom door. He leaned his left shoulder against the trim in the doorway as he spoke.
"Good morning, Dee," he said.
"What happened with you last night?"
"I couldn't find my cell phone," he said.
"But, Aaron, what happened? Your mattress was thrown in the hallway."
"Yeah, I know," Aaron said. "I need to work on that."
The next day, I walked into the team meeting room at One Patriot Place. I sat in the back of the auditorium and saw Tom Brady take a seat in the front row and his teammates fill in around him. When Aaron came in, he spotted me in the back and gave me an upbeat head nod and sat in his assigned chair. Wow, my brother is a patriot, I thought. Coach Belichick entered and stood behind the podium. I had a notebook, an orange and yellow highlighter, and three pens. I was worried about running out of ink, and I tried to write down every word he said. "What type of improvements have you made as a player this offseason?" Belichick asked the team. "What type of player are you? Has your performance declined? Has your performance inclined? Are you a roller coaster? Are you consistent? Do things right all the time. Be consistent." I helped the quarterbacks and wide receivers coaches as needed. In staff meetings, I sat in a chair off to the side and against the wall. I was just thankful for the experience, and I planned to take what I learned back with me to Iowa. One of my assignments was a red zone study in which I analyzed the Patriots' most productive plays inside their opponent's 20-yard line from the previous season. One afternoon, Aaron joined me in the tight end's meeting room, and together we continued studying the film. He shared with me everything he had been taught and the goal of each play. For a few minutes, it was like we were back in high school together. The next day, I spotted Aaron during practice. He wasn't participating due to a shoulder injury and was walking behind the offensive huddle. He had such an angry look on his face. It was the Aaron of the failed Christmas photo, and it caused me to do a double take. I immediately asked him, "Are you okay?" He nodded and said, "Everything is cool." I thought he was frustrated because he couldn't practice at full speed. We both carried on with work. On my final day of the internship, I took a photograph of my locker and my nameplate that read D. Hernandez. I then took a picture of Aaron's locker and his nameplate, A. Hernandez. On the plane ride back to Iowa, I couldn't stop looking at these pictures. I thought about how proud our dad would have been that his boys were together. Not only that, but for a few days at least, we were on the same team, the team Aaron grew up rooting for.
Chapter 26.
June 2013. On Saturday, June 15th, my mother was scheduled to have breakfast with Aaron, Shai, and the baby. But when my mother arrived at Aaron's house, he was nowhere to be found. Around 11 a.m., Aaron and Odin Lloyd pulled into the driveway in a black Suburban, a vehicle that Aaron had rented. My mom saw Aaron hand Odin the keys.
"I don't need it," Aaron said to Odin. "Just bring it back to the rental car place on Monday."
Aaron was intoxicated. "Drunk as a skunk," my mom said. "He was wearing different clothes than what he went out in the previous night. He didn't come home." The next day, June 16th, was Father's Day. Aaron had a picnic with Shai and Aviel. When my mother asked him how it went, Aaron said he enjoyed the day. "The picnic was a stepping stone in the right direction," my mom said. "I didn't think Aaron was the father he needed to be. He was always staying out late with his buddies, and he wasn't treating Cheyenne with enough respect." Late in the workday the following Tuesday, I was sitting at my desk in Iowa City when my phone rang. It was Aaron. Over the phone, I was a motor mouth, going on about how much I enjoyed my internship with the Patriots. Aaron finally interrupted.
"Dee, will you please stop talking?"
Something in the tone of his voice made me feel that something was terribly wrong, a brother's intuition. For a split second, I thought maybe something happened to our mother or our grandmother or our father's twin brother, who had been battling cancer. Aaron continued.
"Listen," Aaron said. "Do you remember Odin?"
"Sure."
"Odin is dead," Aaron said. "I just want you to know, because you're my brother and I love you. He was found, and they're trying to investigate, and my name is being thrown around." I felt frozen in my own body.
"So, did you do it?"
"Dee, I swear on everything I didn't do it," he said.
He told me he couldn't talk and said, "I love you, Dee." As soon as I hung up with Aaron, I couldn't get his words out of my mind. Odin is dead. My name is being thrown around. Odin is dead. My name is being thrown around. I heard the knob to my office door begin to rattle as I saw it rotate before opening. One of the coaches on staff asked if everything was okay with my brother.
"What do you mean?" I asked.
He said he had just seen something about Aaron on television.
Surely, I thought, what Aaron had told me wasn't already making national news.
The coach left and shut the door. I grabbed a black rain jacket from my closet and placed it on the hook on the back side of my door, covering the one small window. I didn't want anyone to see my face. I turned on the television. Then, I saw the words crawling across the bottom of the screen. "Police are investigating Aaron Hernandez in connection with a possible homicide. Odin Lloyd has been found shot to death in an industrial park near Hernandez's house." I wanted to hide. I wanted to disappear. But more than anything, I wanted to hug my brother and tell him everything would be all right. As I tried to process what had happened, my mother called. All I could hear was her sobbing so hard that she was out of breath.
"What did I do wrong?" she finally said.
I continued to try to comfort her. As I spoke, my phone beeped at least a dozen times, calls from concerned friends and family members, as well as reporters. We hung up. I couldn't bear to watch any more television. Aaron's face was now on ESPN, so I turned it off. I removed the raincoat off the hook and peeked out my window to see if any coaches or players were nearby. It was all clear. I bolted out of my office, into the parking lot, and into my car. That night I couldn't sleep. Tossing and turning, I prayed that my brother had nothing to do with Odin's death, that it was one big misunderstanding. I had no reason not to believe him. I feared how Coach Kirk Ferentz would react to the news, and how he would confront me the next day. I thought he might call me into his office and say, "We have to let you go.
Our program can't be associated with the negative attention surrounding your brother. I wasn't sure if I would still have a job in a few hours. I couldn't believe how one short phone call could completely change my life. The next morning, June 19th, a Wednesday, my mom was getting ready for work in Bristol when Aaron called her. He said it would be nice if I could come to his house for support if I wanted to, my mom said. I went to work and told my boss that I was going to Aaron's. On the drive there, I had a knot in the pit of my stomach. I just knew that our lives would never be the same again. I just knew because it didn't add up. Something was wrong. I prayed to God that if Aaron was guilty and he really did this, that he would be put away.
As our mom neared Aaron's house, she saw about a dozen television trucks parked near his driveway.
A news helicopter hovered above. A swarm of reporters and strangers stood in the street, gawking at the house. My mom squeezed through the crowd and went inside. Aaron wasn't home. He was at the stadium with the team. Aaron called the house and asked me to come and pick him up, my mom said. Once he came out and got in my car, I started asking him questions. As always, Aaron said, "Everything's going to be okay, Mom." I drove to his house crying and placing my hand on his leg just above his knee, like I always did when I was driving with you boys. I had to go home. That morning, I explained the situation to Coach Ferentz, and he couldn't have been more supportive, telling me to take as much time as I needed to be with my family. At the airport, it seemed like every television was tuned to a station that was showing pictures of my brother.
I stood there staring at Aaron and then looked around and saw dozens of others stopped in their tracks by this breaking news.
A few days later, state police entered the front door of Aaron's house with search dogs to look for possible evidence. I watched it all on television from a friend's home in Connecticut. I wanted to be there with Aaron, but I knew I couldn't do anything for him. That time had passed. And I was worried about my face being plastered on television if cameras caught me exiting my car and walking into his home, the same thing that had happened to my mom. As the police conducted their search, Aaron, Shai, Aviel, my mom, Shai's mom, and Shai's sister were ushered into the sunroom. They all sat in silence, except for Aaron. Aaron was acting like everything was perfectly fine, my mom said. He made jokes and was his regular self. That night, my mom stayed at Aaron's. He brought her a small yellow bag of Lay's classic potato chips and relaxed with her on the bed in the spare bedroom. They watched the news that was being broadcast from the front of Aaron's house as my mom rubbed Aaron's back. She asked him if he was scared. I was, but not anymore, Mom, he said. Chapter 27 June 2013. 4 days later, a Sunday, my mom left Aaron's home and drove back home to Bristol. She was convinced that this had all been a mix-up and that Aaron would not be arrested. She thought the only reason his name had been associated with Odin's death was that she saw Aaron hand Odin the keys to the Black Suburban 8 days earlier. On the morning of June 26th, a Wednesday, I went to the beach, hoping to escape everything for a few hours. But within minutes of placing my towel on the sand, my phone rang. It was my mother, and she was screaming.
"They are taking him," she said. "They are taking my baby. They are coming to arrest him."
"I'm coming home now," I said. I grabbed my sandals and ran to the car. I flipped the ignition and pushed the pedal to the floor with my bare foot. I wove through traffic on the highway, concerned about only one thing: reaching my mother, whose screams echoed in my ears the entire drive. When I got to her house, my mom was clinging to the living room wall like she had no strength in her legs. I wrapped my arms around her before we settled on the couch to watch what was happening to Aaron. The camera zoomed into Aaron's front door. Then it opened, and I saw Aaron appear. He was wearing long red shorts that bounced a few inches lower than his kneecaps. His shoes were black, a low-cut training shoe. He had on a white short-sleeve V-neck T-shirt, but the sleeves just draped over the side of his body because his arms were not in them. His wrists were handcuffed behind his back, as two detectives in dark suits directed him out onto his porch and toward a police car parked in his driveway. We didn't know what would happen next. I sat in front of the television and watched the footage of my brother being hauled away in handcuffs again and again. It was a nightmare on repeat. About an hour later, the live news coverage shifted to the inside of a Massachusetts courtroom, where Aaron was appearing for his arraignment. His lawyer put his hand on Aaron's shoulder as Aaron stood in front of the judge, licking his lips, his eyes straight ahead.
"My baby, my baby, my baby," my mom kept saying as we watched. "I can't believe this is happening to my baby."
I turned up the television volume as the judge and the lawyers began talking.
"I'm going to be sick," my mom said, and left the living room.
I could hear her dry heave in the bathroom, as my eyes remained focused on the screen. A bald man stepped to the podium in the courtroom.
"Your Honor, the defendant is charged with the murder of Odin Lloyd," the assistant district attorney said.
I was horrified. About 2 hours later, a camera showed a white van carrying Aaron to jail. He got out of the van, his arms now in the sleeves of his white V-neck t-shirt. I kept my eyes on Aaron because I didn't know when I would be able to see him again. The next day was a blur of events. Aaron was denied bail. His silver Toyota 4Runner was towed out of Tanya's garage and was linked to an entirely different case, the 2012 drive-by double murder of Daniel De Abreu and Safiro Furtado in the south end of Boston. Reporters repeatedly knocked on our door on Greystone Avenue throughout the afternoon and into the evening. When we didn't answer, they dropped their business cards on the front steps. By sundown, the steps were covered with cards. At one point, my mother and I went out to our backyard. A man approached, claiming to be a friend of my father. He offered his condolences and then began peppering us with questions. My mom started to answer. She didn't understand that this man was actually a reporter and didn't know our family. Until I told her to stop when I noticed him pulling a recording device out of his left pocket. Another reporter offered us Subway sandwiches in return for a few comments. My mom hadn't slept in days. Dark purple bags had formed around her exhausted eyes. We needed to go to the grocery store, so we waited until our street was clear of press. Once the reporters had called it a night, we hurried to our car and drove off. Once inside Price Chopper, I grabbed a ticket at the deli line and waited for my number to be called. The deli clerk turned to me and said, "I saw on TV that you were arrested. How did you get out of jail?" I stared at the clerk, unable to speak. My mom was speechless as well. I clenched my jaw, said nothing about her mistake, and we walked out of the grocery store empty-handed. My high school coach called. "Do you want to go out to dinner?" "That would be great," I said. "I would love to. I need some fresh air." I accepted his offer to pick me up. I went to the basement and found one of my father's black baseball hats in the storage bin. I never wore hats, and pulled the brim low before I walked down the driveway and got into my coach's car. I told him we should go to a restaurant that had dim lighting. I didn't want to be recognized by anyone. Sitting in a corner away from the other customers, we ate chicken wings, and I tried to make small talk, but I couldn't.
I could see my coach's lips moving, yet I couldn't focus on what he was saying.
My mind was overwhelmed with one image: Aaron being led out of his house and into the police cruiser. After dinner, my coach dropped me off at a friend's house. I needed company. We had several cold beers, and then I felt myself breaking down. I went outside and, alone in the dark, sat against the side of his house. I cried and cried and cried. Brian Ferentz had told me to reach out to him if I needed anything at any time. In need of someone now, I called him.
"How are you doing?" he asked.
I couldn't talk. I sobbed into the phone,
and he patiently listened for a few minutes. Eventually, I gathered myself and thanked him for answering and said I was sorry for calling.
"I'm so sorry, DJ," Brian said. "There is no need to apologize to me. Feel free to call me, any time."
Chapter 28 July 2013 I wanted my old life back. A week after Aaron was arrested, one of my aunts in Bristol had a birthday party. Even with my own family, I became more guarded, more closed off. I would ask myself, is it okay to be openly supportive of my brother? Is that right? Does that make me a cold person? I walked into the banquet hall and stood in the back, assessing the room. Music was playing, family members were dancing, and others were conversing at tables. After my aunt's birthday party, I asked a friend out to eat at a local diner. She said yes. My cousin Jay and two of his friends, Todd and Alan, came along as well. As soon as we entered the diner, I felt every set of eyes shift in my direction. I put my head down. The hostess said, "I am so sorry about your brother," and led us to a booth in the back corner. As I walked past the filled tables, I heard the whispers grow louder.
"That's Aaron's brother," one guy said. "That's Aaron's brother."
The five of us took our seats. "I don't care if people say shit to me," I said. "I am not getting involved. Remember that. I am not getting involved." I knew if I got into a fight, it would make national news, and I would lose my job at Iowa. Coaching was the only thing I had. It was my lifeline. As we were reading the menu, two strangers at a nearby table stood up and started walking toward us. One of them said, "Hey, DJ, how's your brother?" He started laughing. I turned to everyone at the table. "Remember what I said." The two guys stood over the end of our table and began making the sound of machine guns with their lips and slapping each other on the back like they had just come up with the joke of the year. My cousin turned to them and said, "Guys, DJ's had a hard enough week as it is. Can you just leave us alone? We don't want any trouble." They laughed again and started making more machine gun sounds. Todd, one of my cousin's friends, looked at them in disgust. "That's not even funny," he said. "It's immature. How old are you guys?" Just then, one of the strangers wound his right hand back and slapped Todd's hat off his head, causing it to fly across the table. Todd rose to his feet and tackled the stranger. Jay jumped over the table and onto the second guy as they both began to gang up on Todd. Alan was walking back from the bathroom and ran at one of the aggressors, driving his shoulder into him, sending him to the ground. Still sitting in my seat, I saw Alan in a chokehold getting smashed in the face, fist after fist. "DJ!" Alan yelled to me. "Help me, damn it!" I shook my head, telling him no. I felt like the biggest coward, but I couldn't risk losing my job at Iowa. Alan escaped the headlock, grabbed a ketchup bottle off the table, and rifled it at one of the guys who was charging toward him. He dodged the bottle, but it popped a customer in the head, dropping her to the ground.
"She's dead!"
another customer screamed. It appeared that the lady who was knocked out on the ground had blood covering her face, but it was the ketchup that had splattered everywhere. As soon as I saw an opening, I walked out of the diner with my friend. It looked like a tornado had ripped through. Tables were torn from the walls and overturned. Booth cushions were spread across the floor, and plates of food and silverware were scattered on the ground. As the two of us drove away from the diner, I saw police cruisers rushing into the parking lot. The next morning, I went to my cousin's house to make sure everyone was okay. Approaching the backyard, I saw my cousin's friends sitting on the picnic table, still wearing what they had on the night before. They had bruises and cuts on their faces. Their clothes were ripped and dotted with dried blood, and their knuckles were swollen. "You look rested," Alan said sarcastically to me.
I told you before it all started that I was not going to get involved, I said. I was getting slammed in the head right in front of you, and you just shook your head no and sat there? I told you I wasn't getting involved, I repeated. My cousin turned to Alan and Todd and said, Enough, guys. If DJ had thrown one punch, it would have been national news because of Aaron's situation. To me, he said, You did the right thing, D. His friends didn't agree. They shook their heads in disgust and limped inside. A few hours later, I was back at my mother's home when my iPhone rang. It was a local reporter. Can you please comment about the brawl you were involved in? He asked. I hung up the phone without saying a word and quickly called Coach Kirk Ferentz to tell him what had happened and that I had stayed out of the fight. I don't want to lose my job, and I had nothing to do with it, I said. You did the right thing, DJ, Coach Ferentz said. I appreciate you calling. There is no need to worry. Be safe and let me know if you need anything. That was impossible. I worried about everything. All the time. Chapter 29 July 2013 On the 4th of July, my mother hosted a family barbecue at her house. I sat next to Cheyenne and held Aaron's 8-month-old daughter. I didn't want to let go. I thought about how innocent she was and what effect everything would have on her as she grew older if my brother remained incarcerated. She was Aaron's pride and joy, but had no way of knowing it. My mom went inside for a few minutes and then came running out the back door with her phone in hand. It's Aaron, she yelled. It's Aaron. I handed Aviel back to Cheyenne and followed my mother around the backyard as she spoke to Aaron, waiting for my turn. She gave me the phone. I needed to know how Aaron was holding up. I was surprised by the tone of his voice. He sounded upbeat. I'm doing great, he said. I have to stay positive, D. He asked me to put him on speakerphone. With eight of us huddled close, he asked how Aviel was doing. Then we heard an automated voice say, You have 1 minute. The prison timed his calls. We quickly said our goodbyes, and Aaron was gone again. 1 week later, on July 11th, my mom and I visited Aaron for the first time. That morning, sitting in our childhood bedroom, I put on my outfit. The prison had a strict dress code. I never hated putting on nice clothes so much in my life. I tried to imagine how different things would be if our father were still alive. I heard my mother crying as she dressed in her room. I was afraid to see Aaron. For weeks, I'd type his name in my computer search browser because I still struggled to believe he was in this mess. It didn't seem real. I needed proof. It was like I'd become a motivational speaker for myself. I needed to reassure myself that I could keep my emotions in check while visiting my brother in the worst place imaginable. At just past 8 a.m., my mother and I got in her Nissan Juke and headed to the Bristol County Sheriff's Office in North Dartmouth, Massachusetts. My mother parked the car outside the facility. We entered the lobby of the jail and filled out forms requesting to see Aaron. The waiting room was dark and filled with corrections officers. I sat down and avoided eye contact with anyone. An officer asked me, Are you here for Hernandez? He said. Gosh, you look just alike. We placed our belongings in a small orange locker. I looked at the other visitors and wondered what their stories were. Were they as broken as I was? Waiting to enter the visiting area, my mother whispered to me, How did our lives change so much? They called our names. We walked over to the corrections officers and were patted down before being led into a small stall where we would meet with my brother. There were two steel stools bolted side by side, about 2 feet apart. I took a seat on the left stool, my mother on the right. The stools were cold and uncomfortable. I didn't want to touch anything. For several minutes, my mother and I waited without speaking. A glare reflected off the glass into our faces,
making it hard to see through to the other side, where my brother would eventually be sitting. We heard a few loud bangs coming from somewhere out of view. My body grew tense. It was like I was meeting my brother for the first time. An officer led Aaron to the glass. I struggled to see his face as I moved my head to the left and then to the right, trying to find a clear line of sight. Aaron started laughing at me. He could see us perfectly from his seat. All I could see was a silhouette of his head. My mother grabbed the phone off the wall and held it between us. The silver cord was short and stiff, so I had to lean to the right edge of my stool to get my ear to the phone. It was quiet at first, and I didn't know what to say. Aaron's voice went in and out, like we had poor reception. So my mother hung up the phone and we talked the best we could through the glass. Aaron was thrilled that we took the time to visit him. He was convinced that everything was in God's hands.
In college, he had "In God's Hands" tattooed on his right forearm.
There were so many things I wanted to say to Aaron, but I knew I couldn't. Getting mad at him wouldn't do any good for any of us. So at first I sat there simply looking at his face, trying to read how he was feeling. He started smiling and cracking jokes like he did when we were younger. It was almost like he went back to the kid I knew on Greystone Avenue, sitting across from me at the dinner table, making me smile as we completed our homework assignments. I stood up to get a clear view of him. He did the same. Now I saw him, and I noticed his face shift. I felt his sadness, like he knew this was his new reality. I could tell it was a side of him that he didn't want us to see because he quickly snapped out of it. He said something funny and I started joking around too, telling him amusing stories about anything I could think of, trying to get him to smile and to get my mind off this tragic situation. I wanted him to be able to close his eyes and have something positive to think about back in his prison cell, isolated and alone. Visiting hours ended. This was going to be the last time I would see him before I traveled back to Iowa, and I didn't know when I'd be in a room with him again. Since our father passed, we never said goodbye to each other. It was too concrete. So I said, "I love you. I'll see you later." As Aaron walked out of the room, I tried to freeze the image of him through the glass in my mind. I didn't want to let go. Chapter 30. Fall, 2013. I flew back to Iowa. I found a thick stack of sympathy cards stuffed in my mailbox, which I read at my desk. I was reminded again of what I wanted to forget. My brother was in jail. There were times I would walk past a TV in the lobby that was tuned to ESPN and hear commentators talking about Aaron's downward spiral. Shortly after returning, a few recruits and their families were touring the facility. ESPN was on again, and the topic was my brother. I ran into our recruiting coordinator's office and asked if we should change the channel on the television because I didn't want them to think negatively about the university. 3 days a week, I jogged around campus, and I started getting texts from friends asking how my run was going. I later found out that people had been tweeting that Aaron Hernandez's brother was jogging through campus. I couldn't outrun the reality even in Iowa. I was worried that my tight ends wouldn't respect me anymore, or that they would be afraid of me because of everything my brother was involved in. So one afternoon I called all six of them into my office. I stood in front of them and said, "My brother's situation has nothing to do with us as a team," I said. "We must dominate this season." "Coach," one of the players said, "we have your back." Our season flew by. We finished 8-5 and lost in the Outback Bowl to LSU, 21-14. My brother tried to watch as many of our games as he could, and I always looked forward to discussing our performance with Aaron. I'd been dating a girl in Iowa for several months. After the season, for her birthday, we went to Formosa Restaurant near campus with her sister and her sister's fiancé. We were seated at a table which faced a floor-to-ceiling window,
Midway through our meal, I noticed a group of people outside on the sidewalk stop in their tracks and point at me. They pretended to shoot and kill each other and fall to the ground dead. My body turned stiff, and our conversation turned awkward. After dinner, we moved to a nearby bar for a nightcap. As I stood inside, a few people approached me and asked how it felt to be a murderer's brother. I told my girlfriend, "I'm out of here." I rode in a taxi to my apartment at 906 Benton Avenue. I entered the door, threw my Christmas tree to the other side of the living room, and walked to the kitchen. I grabbed the largest knife from my wooden knife block and stormed into the bathroom. I turned the light on and stared at myself in the mirror. It was like I was seeing past myself into a dark place. I visualized pushing the knife through my chest. I tightened my grip with my right hand, squeezing the knife so hard that my fingernails were pressing into my palm, nearly causing it to bleed. I was ready to end the pain. I was convinced that the blade was my escape, my only answer. I extended my right arm away from my body before bringing it back into my chest. My hand nicked the bottom of the mirror and, like that, I snapped out of the dark world I was in, like I woke up from a blackout. I remember seeing my cheeks covered with tears in the mirror. I dropped the knife into the sink and stumbled into my bedroom, where I sat on the floor, rocking back and forth. After a while, I called my mother. She answered, but I couldn't talk. I just sighed heavily into the phone, over and over and over. "Are you okay, DJ?" she asked. I didn't respond. "Dee, what is wrong?" she asked. "I can't take this anymore, Mom," I said, as I cried uncontrollably. "You've got to go to counseling, DJ," she said. "I went and it helped me. You've got to go." Instead of attending class the next Monday, I was working on a second master's, I drove to the campus counseling department. In the parking garage, I pulled the hood of my black Iowa sweatshirt over my head because I didn't want anyone to recognize me. I didn't want to appear damaged or weak or as if I couldn't handle what was going on in my life. I walked up a flight of stairs and into the counseling office. I filled out paperwork but didn't sign my name, afraid someone would call it out loud. As I sat in a chair with my head buried in a magazine, one of the counselors came to the waiting area and asked if she could help me. I said yes and followed her into her office. I told her I couldn't think for myself, I couldn't focus, and I couldn't control the negative thoughts attacking me. It was like something had taken control over my mind and was continuing to pump it with the worst images from my life. After speaking a short while, she explained that after my third individual session, I would have to transition to group counseling. There was no way that was happening. I feared word getting out on social media that Aaron Hernandez's brother has entered counseling. I thanked the counselor for her time and left the office. I found a different counselor who could meet with me first thing in the morning. I had never lied to our offensive coordinator or head coach before, but now I told the staff I had a morning class. I didn't want them to know I was seeking help. During our first session, I remained closed off. There was no chance I was going to tell him how I'd almost ended my life a few nights before. But over time, I began to open up about Aaron and the negative thoughts I had. I explained how it felt like every person I was close to had left me, my dad, my ex-wife, and now my brother. I began to push everyone in my life away because I didn't want to take the chance of getting hurt again. It was a relief to let all of this out. After a few weeks, I had hope for better days and for a dramatic change in my life, a change I needed personally. It was the start of a long process of finding balance and overcoming my depression. The books my counselor recommended for me, The Secret, The Four Agreements, The Fifth Agreement, and The Mastery of Love, were the same books Aaron was beginning to read in prison. Chapter 31. January 2015.
On the morning of January 19th, I exited the elevator at the Justice Center in Fall River, Massachusetts. Today was a big day. The beginning of opening statements in Aaron's trial. Wearing a gray sport coat